Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige film. Today, we're going all the way back to 1987 to talk about a rom-com called Moonstruck. Moonstruck is directed by Norman Jewison, which I was like, who the fuck is this guy? Sometimes it happens and I'm like, oh, I know. I know who the fuck this guy is. This man won an Academy Award in three different decades for The Heat of the Night in 1967, Fiddler on the Roof 1971, and Moonstruck 1987. I've now seen all three. He also directed the OG Thomas Crown Affair, Jesus Christ Supercar. Wait.
That racing.
Jesus Chrysler Supercar. Yeah.
Catholic racing movie.
And Rollerball. It was written by John Patrick Shanley, who turned out wrote one of my favorite movies of all time, Joe vs. Volcano.
Huh.
He also wrote Congo and Doubt, the recent Philip Seymour Hoffman joint. Well, I guess it's not recent. It's been a while. Starring Cher. She got one word. She needs no introduction. It's Cher. Nicolas Cage. He's got two names. Needs no introduction. Not the Bald Move crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Not with the Nick Cage film fest under our belts. Vincent Gardenia, who was in The Hustler and Grease Lightning, Olympia Dukakis, who I've seen in Working Girl, Steel Magnolias, and Look Who's Talking. Danny Aiello, from Leon the Professional and Godfather Part 2, and John Mahoney, who everyone knows as Frasier's papa.
Yep.
From the hit show Frasier. I liked Moonstruck. I remember this has got one of the most memorable like movie posters of all time, the giant moon over New York City with Cher doing like her, you know, hair back, and she's in her fancy Met Gala, Met opera dress. And I had no idea what to expect. I was expecting something a little bit more serious and dramatic. But this is kind of almost a rom-com farce. There is a few like really grounded moments of sweetness, but it's a lot of people just acting crazy in love.
Yeah, I expected something more serious too, because the whole reason we did this movie as a prestige film is because it won Oscars. It didn't win Best Picture, but it won Oscars for Cher. It won Oscars for a couple of other people. Olympia Dukakis won. Yeah, and it was nominated for Best Picture, and we were like, okay, this, you know, we've heard of this movie and it's got some acclaim, so let's do it. And I expected something more serious. I didn't think the Academy would be nominating quirky romantic comedies for Oscars, but they did, apparently, because this is not a very serious movie at all.
It has moments of serious. It's like a philosophically serious movie, maybe.
Occasionally. You know,
there's like, it's saying things about love, and there's a lot of things. It's also just crazy romantic, and like, and I keep on, this is part of the Bald Move lexicon, into Anna Green Gables sense. Like, there's very few depictions of what I would say are like what I would describe as like healthy relationships and mature relationships. Maybe Ray and Rosie. Is one of those ones, the brother of the dad. No, it's the brother of Olympia Dukakis and his wife.
Okay,
because he was telling the story about Cosmo, is the guy coming to court his sister. I don't know, there's just a lot. It's like a lot of different stories. There's some big performances, some funny performances, some poignant scenes. And it's very much like just a set of different scenes showing different combinations of older people and various stages of love and heartbreak and reconciliation. And it also felt like a big, like kind of like a stage play. And that like you kind of like in that way that there was like these kind of disconnected scenes, different settings, and then it all comes into like a big climax. Like it's just like this big overstuffed scene where all the movie's business gets settled in like 5 minutes. But I liked it. I liked it.
This movie is, having not seen any of them as far as I'm aware of, this is a movie that feels like what I imagine a Woody Allen movie to be. Am I wrong about that?
I've not seen many Woody Allen films, because I saw a couple when I was in that kind of like AFI top 100, and I'm like, this sucks.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt. The tone of this movie is so bizarre to me. Maybe because I was expecting something out of this movie more serious. And so, like, when Danny Aiello shows up in these first scenes with Cher, and his performance is so strange and awkward if this were, like, an actual serious film, but it's not quite funny enough for me to be like, okay, this is obviously not supposed to be serious. I just couldn't tell what he was doing. And so I was really thrown off for the first, like, 10 minutes of this movie, going, what am I watching? And it was really only when you get to some of the family stuff that I started going, okay, this is actually a rom-com more than anything. It's a comedy, not a serious film. And the farce and, you know, all those things. It just took me a long time to settle into what this movie was doing because it was so different from what I expected or what I thought this movie was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I thought... I didn't expect this much like of a serious performance from Cher. I thought it would be like zanier or like a more broadly comedic, but I thought she's like a really good protagonist.
She feels like the only real person in this entire movie.
That's a
except for Olympia Dukakis, who feels very real as well.
Yeah.
Everybody else is just a caricature of a human being.
This movie also reminds me a lot of like, did you ever see that My Big Fat Greek Wedding?
No.
Where it's like, it's all around this woman who's kind of like being carried around by circumstances. And she's propelled by this like super colorful family and extended family that has like, you know, quintessentially, you know, they're an American immigrant family where it's like, you know, the grandpa's like fucking essentially still living in on the islands, and then the dad is kind of, and then the Cher and the Nick Cage is kind of like more or less American. It had a lot of that kind of DNA in it, and I like that. I like because I have a big colorful extended family who's a bunch of fucking rednecks from the hills of Indiana, and like there's always a similar energy to that kind of arrangement when you've got intergenerational. People who have been like started at the bottom floor of like and then kind of worked their way up, and some people have made it, some people haven't, and some people have gotten their arms cut off in a tragic bread slicing accident, and they're bitter about it. And I like that. It feels like being over at my granddad's house for a big family get together or something. So I always like movies that have these kind of big, boisterous, larger than life images or families.
And it's also a pretty fantastical movie. It's that's the romantic part that you're talking about, is where like the moonstruck concept comes in, right? Where there's some whimsy there. And I think that's the part I liked the most, is the concept of being moonstruck and tying it to love and the physical act of love, right? In some of these scenes, the amore that Dean Martin's singing about.
It also ties in the theme, like, you know, like there's like a almost a Beauty and the Beast thing, because Nick Cage is described as an animal on several occasions.
Yeah, you got the eye of the wolf.
He's a wolf, and he's going to eat a person up, and he's going to chew his own leg off. And there's this that's one of the themes.
It transforms you, right? Like it's something physical that happens to you that you can't help but. And they say it, you know, it turns the men into wolves, but it also attracts the women, right? The women come to you during the moonstruck phase. I don't know. During Cosmo's moon, I think is what he calls it.
Right.
At some point, because he saw his brother outside the window with one of these moons, and
he drug it over from his. Yeah,
I don't know what he was doing outside that window. I don't know. Is this John Cusack bared his anything ass kind of thing, or is this?
It's like he's just bared his big white ass. These kind of themes of like, you know, transformation and like some of the monstrous nature of love, because like Nick Cage gives this pitch for it that sounds terrible, like, you know, love's not supposed to be nice, love's supposed to tear us apart and ruin us, and we're supposed to fall in love with the wrong people. All this, there is this another tension in the movie, is this concept of like love versus fear, you know, like, why do men chase women? Because they're afraid of death. You know, why, and why do people worry about it? Because they're afraid the person's going to lose them. And you're afraid to, if you don't do things right, then you'll be cursed. Versus just, you know, giving in and putting aside all the fears about how ridiculous you look and just go be in the moment. I don't know how much of that advice I agree with, but it's that's the nice thing about these kind of comical farces is like you don't have to take a super strong position on it. It's just, you know, Rosie and Ray are really cute in this movie. That's the couple that they're at the window and he's like, you know, in this moonlight with that look on your face, you look 25.
And I think there's an element of truth to all of the various depictions of love in this film, right? I mean, Olympia Dukakis is more along the lines of what I think of as love, which is loyalty and building a life around someone, right? Like when her husband says like, my life's built on nothing. She's like, the fuck, dude, am I nothing? Am I like, is your family nothing? Is your daughter nothing? Has the last 50 years or however long they've been together been nothing? Because she's viewing it from a different angle, right? He's fearful. He's worried that like somehow he's not a man in his old age or something, or that, you know, he hasn't, I don't know, boned enough chicks or something. Who knows? But like there's that element too, right? Where like love is passion also. And you see that in the Nick Cage Cher relationship where passion just overrides logic.
It seems like there's something in that that theme that speaks to Norman Jewison, because that's one of the central things in Fiddler on the Roof. You know, the two, Tevye and his wife, you know, were in this arranged marriage, and you know, they're older, their girls are all nearing marrying age, and they're older and grayer, and you know, he's kind of they're poor, and there's a scene in the middle of the movie where he's like, do you even love me? Because like, did we, you know, like his daughters are not wanting to do the arranged marriage. They want to marry whoever they love. And like, what is this bullshit love? You get signed by the matchmaker and there's this whole duet where it's like, do you love me? And she's like, you know, I've washed your clothes for 25 years. I've buried your children. I've milked your cows. I've done and like it's a big, but do you love me? It's like, I put up with your bullshit. I've done. And at the end of this, like they do realize that like after this whole life that they've got thrust together, they have built something that is enduring in love. But there's also contrast to people who they were the lucky ones that kind of like were able to navigate that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. The arranged marriage shit is bogus, but.
Yeah. But there's like that kind of like, what does it mean to be in love? And the two facets, the fact that like the moonstruck, like very young person, like I need to like climb inside your skin and like be that close to you and like just ravenous, you know, versus the mature, the what you're left with at the end of a long life together. And some people value it and some people scorn it. It's really interesting.
And some people are afraid of it. Right. I mean, that's part of this movie. That's the part of the movie I like, the part that deals with the different concepts of love and how all of those things are a certain type of love. And, you know, it's probably good that you feel all of them, not just one, because I don't know where Cher and Nicolas Cage go from here, where Ronnie and Loretta end up. But this is certainly a high-powered start to their relationship. But it has to be more than that, right? Because it could be another bread slicer incident. What, he's still got a hand to lose. If the other hand goes in the bread slicer, then suddenly he's blaming her for it, and she's out the door, and anger, and that stuff, right? There's got to be something else there.
If you try to analyze this relationship outside of the bounds of the movie, there's so many
I
was never fully living my life until I met you. And like anytime you meet someone for the first time and it's both kind of a rebound and you're saying shit like, dude, you're the one piece in my life that's complete. It's like this flashing red lights and all. Uh-huh. But I think it works in the framework of the movie. Should I give it like a broad description of what this movie is about? If people are like, what the hell is this 40-year-old movie starring Cher and Nick Cage? It's all about Moonstruck is about. You said her name is Lonnie?
Loretta, I think.
Lori, is that what they call her? It's Cher.
Sure, it's Cher.
She's a middle-aged woman, a divorcee, whose husband died when she married young. The husband died. She's kind of afraid that her life is cursed. She's with this man now, Johnny, who treats her okay and, you know, can provide for her okay.
He's
and
a dipshit.
And he's just like, you know, and he proposes marriage because he's about to go overseas to visit his sick mother. And before he goes off, he asks her to invite his brother. They've had a rupture and he wants to settle this at their wedding. So she agrees. Turns out his brother is Nick Cage, mm-hmm. who is an animal and has lost his hand in a tragic bread slicing accident and is really mad that I lost my hand. I lost my woman. Johnny has his hand. Johnny has his woman. And he does the Nick Cage thing. And you think, and like, that's the thing, all the interactions is like her realizing this guy is a beast of a man, but there's also that charisma. That's something that like there is that kind of like animal need that she feels towards, Nick Cage, she doesn't feel towards his brother Johnny. So is it Ronnie? Yeah, it's Ronnie and Johnny.
Yeah, Ronnie and Johnny. Yeah,
Ronnie and Johnny. The movie is them kind of dancing around the idea of being in a relationship because, like, that's so inappropriate. I'm betrothed to your brother, mm-hmm. and versus like, we're both kind of miserable. Why don't we go for it? And then
yeah, literally the next day after getting engaged, she sleeps with his brother. So
yeah, and it's like the escalation that happens there is like out of nowhere. So that's half of the movie. The other half of the movie is all the relationships orbiting around this one. The relationship between Cher's mom and her father, the relationship between her mother's brother and his wife, the relationship between her grandfather and this the relationship that her mother forms outside, like both her mother and father form outside the marriage in ways that are kind of scandalous and ways that are not. Like there's mm-hmm. tons and tons. It's kind of like saying that the Pulp Fiction is about Marcellus Wallace's briefcase.
Cool. Yeah.
Nick Cage and Cher's relationship is that main plot that ties everything together, but there's just a whole lot of shit going on mm-hmm. In the margins of this film. And again, it's like it's a really great performance. And there's a lot of the stuff is like in this movie set up around dualities too.
Yeah.
Is that like there's a scene where she talks about when Johnny proposes to her, she's like, you got to get down on your knees because that's what people do. And you got to promise me like her first marriage she describes as cursed because it was a young love and they got married at a courthouse in front of strangers and there's no family involved. And the father didn't bless it and the husband died and she's been. So it's like she's afraid to get this curse. And then like there's another scene like 10 minutes after she goes through this impassioned thing about how she can't because she's avoiding this curse where she finds this old woman who is actively hexing this airplane that's taking her sister across. I think it's actually maybe her boyfriend's in there too, her fiance. But she's taking it to the old country and she stole her man like 40 years ago. She's just like, I want this plane to fall out of the sky and crash into the city or drown in the ocean. And she's going on and on and on. And like, Cher's just looking at her and she's like, well, I don't believe in curses, which is funny. Because we just saw in the other scene how terribly afraid she is of this curse. Yeah. And then the old lady says, eh, me either. And I just thought that was like, it's kind of a lot of this movie in a microcosm because people get worked up mm-hmm. over nothing. And then the resolution is just kind of like a shrug. Yeah, you're right. I should probably do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Okay, I don't think we talked about this on the podcast proper because it's something we were kind of yucking about in the Twitch pre-show. You're an Italian American.
I am. Yeah.
What's the, and your dad? That's what, so we're talking about. Like, your dad's not in this movie.
No, my dad is the brother, Cosmo's brother.
Yeah, I know we've talked about it from time to time, but your dad is like very much an Italian American.
Yeah,
like, you know, he's got the
looks
New York.
Like it. He talks like, yeah, he grew up in New York.
In the
40s and 50s. So, like,
he really does look like a character in the periphery of like a Godfather or a Goodfellas movie, or, you know, if you don't want to go gangster, sure, then of a Moonstruck.
Yeah.
How does it feel like? Do you, because how much of your family is like him? Is he kind of like parachuted into a normal WASPy family?
Oh, no. Well, my immediate family. Yeah, I mean, he didn't like preserve many of the traditions if he had them as a kid. And his
no
mother,
pasta fagioli or gabagool, or
none of the, like, you know, stereotypically Italian things. I had a pretty Midwestern kid life or whatever. And his mother is not Italian. So, like, his father's Italian, came over from Italy in the 20s or something. I don't know. And then, you know, married a woman who's just like French or something. I don't know. I don't know what she
was. Controversial. Early assimilator, you know, going.
Yeah. No, they didn't like try and
find
stick
a nice
with,
Italian girl
find
and stand
Italian
down.
Girl settled down. Yeah. None of that stuff. So I did not have like a very Italian upbringing, but I could see that he was a lot closer to it than I was, for sure. Like, I could picture his house being far more Italian when he was a kid than mine was. Something along the lines of this, but not all the way to like a Godfather level type of Italian, right? Because this is somewhere in the middle. This is not extremely Italian.
It's a ton of generations too. You can see, like, right, every time you go step back, it's a
drift,
little bit more Italian. And towards grandpa still speaking like full on Italian sentences. And
yeah, I'm more the Cher in this movie, and he would definitely be closer to a Cosmo or I don't know his brother's name.
I think it's Ray. I think it's Rosie and Ray.
Ray, I think you're right. Yeah.
But Rosie might be the Olympia Dukakis. I wasn't sure.
I can't find it. Yeah, it's probably Ray. He's the only one without a picture on IMDb. So
yeah, but I don't know. I got a big kick out of that.
It feels right though. This felt like someone who was writing about something he sort of knew about. And I don't know what Shanley's background is. I didn't look that up, but it felt right. It felt like a family who's been here for a few generations now, and still, you know, feels roughly Italian because it's a tight-knit family. I mean, that's the other thing, right? They're all living together. Yeah. They all live together in one house. And so I would think those traditions would be preserved a lot more than if they had spread out.
There's a lot in the early goings where I was wondering why things were happening. Like, out of the blue, you'd cut away. And it's before I knew the characters really well. It's like I just met her father, and then you know, and around the dinner table. And then I see him taking this woman out. Or then he has a sales scene where he's a plumber. He's trying to upsell copper pipes on people. And he's telling this to another woman. I'm like, what? Is this the same? Like, is this somebody? Because is the dad the same as the person who's selling? And is it? And they introduce this concept very early on, before I felt any way about the characters, of her father having an affair. Mm-hmm. And I thought, it's like, what the fuck is this? But like, they set a lot of those things in motion, like in the very early going, so it can all kind of like come to a head in like the third act and mm-hmm. the resolution. But still, that all came together at the end. Like I said, there's a scene at the end around the dinner table where like all the family hash gets settled. I don't know exactly where they were going with it, though, because there is some good stuff from Olympia Dukakis, especially when she's got Frasier's dad kind of like roasting in the scene at the dinner. But like the resolution of that, of like, hey, you know what? Stop cheating on me and go to confession. I felt like that felt pretty hollow and kind of not worth it. Like what?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what's the alternative? Like, she just blows up that relationship after this amount of time. And where does that leave the family? Where does that leave her? Where
it just didn't feel like anything got fixed. Like her saying, like, you're afraid to die. You're still going to die or something like that. And him being like, oh, I'm a man whose life is built on nothing. And she's like, I don't know. It just.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how to take that in like comedies. Right. Like
and especially in a magical realism comedy where like maybe she can just ask the guy and he'll be like, oh, you know what, you're right, I'll give it all up.
Exactly, like the moon has passed, right? Maybe like now that he's not in the werewolf mode of the full phase moon, he can kind of come back to Earth and back to his family and with just a word. But yeah, I don't know, there are a couple of moments that feel weird like that for me. Like one of the biggest kind of letdowns of this movie is the scene at the opera where I expected more from the comedy in this scene. I expected more from what's clearly set up to be a moment of tension, right? Where like, these two couples who aren't supposed to be together are both at the same opera. And there's not much.
It's just very like, matter of fact. Yeah. Yeah. He's like, hey, you know, you didn't see me, I didn't see you.
And then they turn and leave. And I know that's not like the resolution. I know that's, but I expected more from that scene and I didn't get it.
Yeah. It's a couple even like where like I thought I was like, because there's a couple like standout scenes. Anytime Nick Cage is yelling and screaming about love or his life, I think is good. Olympia Dukakis kind of like monologuing to Frasier's dad, and Frasier's dad monologuing about, you know, his version mm-hmm. of destructive love. All that stuff is really good. But then at the end, it's like everything felt very like, you know, there's you're right. This is another example of like, oh, God, the whole movie, this brother has been in Italy and all this shit has happened. Like you're essentially right. You've been cucked by your brother, pre-cucked by your brother. Everything's kind of turned against you. And like, he's heading over and she's nervous, and then Nick Cage is heading over and it's nervous, and like this is a thundercloud about to go off, and then Grandpa comes down and issues this pronouncement about the and then Olympia Dukakis says, I want you to stop cheating, and the dad gets up and he like, bangs his fist on the table. I'm like, oh shit, this old man's about to uncork, we're about to get this an Oscar speech. And he sits down and he goes, okay, like there's a lot of those, and I maybe those are actually funny, because I did laugh when like I would, because I was kind of like, yeah, I'm like, okay, this is the end, like this is good, this will be some fucking fireworks, and the other brother hasn't even arrived yet, and it just does exactly. It just kind of
I do love that scene, that the actual climax of this movie in the kitchen is pretty brilliant. I thought just the way that like the layers come, because you think that first knock, like they set it up, Johnny's coming in the morning, right? He's gonna be here and he's got to talk to you. And I knew what was up. I knew that he was like, I can't go through with the wedding because this is a rom-com and everything has to work out. But like the way that they layer in all these different people, Ronnie shows up and it's like, oh fuck, now he's sitting at the table when Johnny comes home, and this is gonna be disastrous. Uh-huh. And then the dad comes in and, you know, he's been cheating, and the mom confronts him about it. And there's just so many things that are piling on and piling on. And so when Johnny comes in, you're like, oh, fuck, this is going to be great. And then it just kind of goes nowhere, you know? And
it's funny because, like, there's, like, the scene where Johnny, like, she's, like, trying to figure out how she can extract herself. And Johnny's like, you know, my mother's made a miraculous recovery. Got to call off the wedding. And then Cher gets, like, indignant.
Right.
And then Nick Cage has got the, like, what are you saying? And, you know, she throws the ring back at him and then needs to get it back.
I love this part, yeah, where Ronnie then turns to her and is like, Loretta, will you marry me? And she's like, yes. And then he borrows the ring. He borrows his brother's ring, which she just gave back to him, to propose to her to get engaged. Yeah, it's
a little bit that like Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, where it's like, you know, the whole play, they've been building all these different tensions and scenarios, and it comes to a head, and then it's like, oh, well, who, you know.
Like a Coen Brothers movie or something, right? Yeah. Like, what the hell did all this mean? What?
Yeah. There's a couple times where I think you're right, or the movie starts feeling like it's building to a dramatic thing, and then the movie just deflates it, you know, no, this is just a comedy. We're not going to be. And I feel like, yeah, if they made Moonstruck in 2021, it would have some somber places, and it would be a little bit more in the dramedy. But yeah, for an Oscar winning film, this was a lot solid me into like almost as closer to farce than it was to dramedy, for sure.
Yeah.
Slapstick, even in places. Like, literally, like, when Cher slapped Nick Cage, I don't know what they used for the Foley, but it's like the it's the loudest, most cartoonish slap I've ever heard in the history of man. Did you? I got a couple things. Do you like looking at the moon? Do you just like ever like do you go out? How often do you go outside a week? Number one, in the last few years. But number two, do you ever do you like looking up at the moon and being like, oh wow, it's really pretty tonight, or it's a different color, or it's like this phase or that phase?
On occasion, but not. Yeah, I don't track the moon, if that's what you're asking. No.
We're big in this in our family. Like, we will text each other when there's like an especially great moon. And like two nights ago, there was like the barest sliver of a moon I've ever seen. Like, it's like you could Jack tried to deny it was the moon at first. He's like, there's no fuck, because it was also like still kind of daylight, so it's twilight, and it's like, you're not, but like, no, that's like definitely, I love looking at the moon. For a movie called Moonstruck from this well-regarded a director and cinematographer, the moon photography blew ass.
Your moon looks like shit.
It does. It has no feet. I kept on waiting for like, oh, they're going to surely turn the f-stop down and get some. It's just a big fucking white disc.
Yeah.
It's so washed out. It could have been a fake. And you could tell it wasn't, but it's like bad moon photography. What the fuck? You can't have a movie called Moonstruck about how beautiful the moon is. And all the that's the other thing is like they really lit the characters in the moonlight. Like they were kind of glowing, and it was that like cold white light. And it really suits a lot of the skin tone of the actors that they picked. And it looked great, but the moon itself was garbage. and it kind of ruined some of the I liked the what was I seeing, like the old man walking off his dogs and trying to get him to howl. And the old couple being cute and Nick Cage being crazy. But the moon photography was just, I don't know.
Yeah, it was like Man in the Moon stuff. It's just like this washed out white nothing. Yeah,
they had the technology to make good moon shots right back then. Like, it wasn't like, oh, there's just the film can't resolve it, it's just against the night sky. Like, I mean, we
kind
of like the astronauts, you couldn't see the stars on the surface of the moon because they did not have the range back then. Or
damn. I'm sure Armstrong had some Polaroids or something he could have lent them at that point. So yeah, probably.
Yeah. Could have just rotoscoped some NASA shit in there.
Landed on the thing. Let's get some good pictures of it. Yeah.
The other thing, did you notice anything about Nick Cage's teeth?
Yeah, his teeth are fucked in this movie.
Do you know the story behind that?
I don't. It's probably some lunatic thing that he did. He probably had his own teeth pulled and separated and shit for this.
Okay.
No, get out of here.
So for the movie before this, which I think was called Ronnie or Lonnie, coincidentally, he played a Vietnam vet that gets tortured by the Viet Cong. No. And he had babies. So some people don't have adult teeth to come in for certain teeth. Like, I had a friend that their premolars were their baby teeth, and they eventually had to be pulled or capped or something. You have to do something because your baby teeth are not designed for the long haul. But sure. Anyway, his eye teeth, his canines, were baby teeth. And he was going to be tortured. He wanted these pulled with no anesthetic.
Get fucked.
To get into the mind of this guy. And then I guess he thought that that look suited this role, that he's lost a hand, he's down on his luck, and he's skinned. He kept the snake. He kept the missing teeth as to kind of suggest. And then, you know, then he got him fixed after that.
He's supposed to be a wolf. He needs his canines, man.
Well, but it's like a wolf that's already chewed his leg off, right? Uh-huh. Like, yeah, he was a young, strong, proud wolf now, but now he's balding and he's missing some teeth.
Yeah, he looks like a schlub in this movie. He looks terrible in this movie to the point where I'm like not sure why Cher is so attracted to him other than his animalistic moon magic.
I wondered that too until we got to the opera scene. That this is a guy who's got like hidden layers and like Rome, her. It's such a contrast to Johnny, who is not only what you see he is, but probably even less than that.
Yeah.
You know, you're probably making assumptions about a default man that is probably he's deficient in a few areas, where like this for guy's sure. got like, you know, you see this guy missing his hand, missing his teeth. He's shoving dough into an oven. You're like, this guy's not the guy's going to go to the Met and watch an opera.
Yeah,
and he is, and when he shows up, and he's got a tux on, and a night coat, and
which still looks like shit. But okay,
I thought he pulled it off because, like, the thing is like she did too. She like got her.
Great.
Yeah, she got her hair dyed. She got her hair did. She got a new dress, some new shoes, and she was like, and he kind of rose to the occasion. I kind of thought that he might just show up in like the wife beater he's been rocking in every other scene. But no, because like, but. Also, like, that's the thing where it's like, well, that's the magical realism, because this guy in this situation absolutely does not go to the opera. No fucking way.
Probably not. Yeah, but I did appreciate that about him, you know, that he wasn't a one-note character. He's something more than that. But boy, I'm not sure I'm convinced that the performance that Nicolas Cage gives here is good. I think I enjoy the scenes that he's in, but not because of how good they are, just because they're Nick Cage being crazy, especially in the bread scene where he's talking about, I lost my hand, I lost my girl. Yeah, that shit's crazy, and I love it. And I had actually seen that scene before when we were putting together the season of The Cage, and I was doing the trailer. That's one of them, of course, that I pulled. Don't think I used it, but... In the scene where he like convinces her the second time to go to bed with him,
that's the scene where he says, love don't make things nice, it ruins everything. That's the scene you're talking about?
Yes.
All right.
I was not feeling his performance at all in this scene. I thought it was too weird to be convincing.
Weird. Because it felt like a man just
beside himself with desperation.
Like if this didn't happen tonight, he was going to combust.
Sure, yeah. And I get that. They had set that up during the movie, and I that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with the speech. I think, you know, a lot of people probably wouldn't agree with the sentiment or feel the sentiment or whatever, but the speech is fine. He just doesn't deliver the lines like they needed to be delivered, in my opinion. But I don't know. That's just Nick Cage. He never does anything conventionally, and most of the time it ends up working better than if you got some normal actor in there.
Yeah.
This is just an occasion where I don't think it did.
I thought that the Frasier's dad scene with Olympia Dukakis was like really insightful. The idea of like he just like the patheticness of a situation that he is so old and devoid of anything new and young and anything new and vital. I'm trying to avoid the word young. He's just static. And the only thing that changes is every once in a while he'll see a pretty face in his class who's a professor. And she's so full and she doesn't know. And like everything's new to her. It's another way to say she's naive and inexperienced. And it's very easy to impress her with like, you know, his life experience and education. And there's always a moment where he realizes that they've realized that he's an old, used up husk bag. And then he's like, it's like then the cycle repeats. And I'm like, well, you dumb asshole, stop dating 20-year-olds. Like, you're 55 years old. You're a tenured professor. Like, you got another 10 years of this, and time's going to be up, fucking buddy. Like,
yeah, you're looking good now, but eventually you're going to look like Cosmo. So, yeah.
And also the reason they're making these realizations is not just because you're an old, used-up windbag, but because they're realizing that you are using them. You're like, Lena Dunham, of all people, was on a podcast with Bill Simmons, and she mentioned this about there's guys in Hollywood who she called their light stealers. That, like, young people come on the scene and they're full of, like, energy and like, these are, like, emotional vampires that, like, latch on and stuff. Like, right. And that's what he's doing. And I just, like, thank God that this movie, like, Olympia Caucus was, like... Because I thought they're going to be like, oh, they're going to get moonstruck and this is going to be kind of like a whole deal. But like, nah, she's like, I know who I am and I know who you are. And I'm so glad because like I thought that they were going to force a December, November relationship on them. I'm like, no, that's not what he needs.
Yeah, no, I agree.
He needs to date people his own fucking age and his own experience level and or not be such a shit, not suck the juice and marrow out of his young conquests. One of those two.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a tragic character. I think, what he needs is probably to just figure out who he is and appreciate the thing that he has built, right? Like, he's a professor. He's well-educated. He's well-learned. He is a guy who should be very confident and very comfortable in his own skin, but he seems the opposite, right? He seems
very
like
lazy. Yeah.
I mean, he's smooth. He's like a good talker. He's attractive. He's well put together, but like he's still pining for a bygone era, right? For him, a different time. And I think that's the tragedy of this is not the like, you know, it's not great that he is like trying to latch on and suck the life out of these younger women. But the thing that he's really doing here, I think, is trying to recapture something about himself from that time. So,
but that would require real change and transformation and working on his act to like impress people who are not
he's
like
taking a shortcut.
Completely wet behind the ears. Yeah.
But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I got out of that speech, and maybe I misinterpreted it, but what I got out of that speech is that when he sees these young women in his class, he's picturing himself there. I think he literally says that, like, I see them and I see me in their position, in their chair, right? When he was fresh and young and learning things, that's what excites him about these relationships is that he can get something of himself back.
Yeah. And it is like from time to time I get to hang out with young people. My son's a teenager and I've got, friends in their 20s and 30s. And it is interesting to hang out with people, different generations and experience levels, because you get different perspectives and it does keep you like from like going, but like, yeah, this guy's, going a bit above and beyond, I think that's his problem, right? As he wants to continue to recapture that experience because he doesn't know how to do it in his own. He doesn't know how to stay vital in his own life.
Sure. Yeah. That, and he doesn't know how to be comfortable with the loss of vitality that naturally happens either. Right. Whereas Olympia Dukakis, I think, transmutes that into a sort of a life that has been and a life that is currently, but like, the things that she's built along the way with that vitality are important and precious to her. Whereas he doesn't seem to feel like he's built anything.
Fears death.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Death and hell. Whereas Nick Cage doesn't fear death, doesn't fear burning in hell. There's like, it's a lot of contrast. Like I said, I've only seen his movie once. I imagine if I watched it more, and I could probably watch it again because Cecily wanted to, and she missed it. So I'll probably end up watching it again in a weekend coming soon. But like, I imagine there's a lot of like, nice gems and symmetries there where it's like you've got the men who are no good in the film and they're deficient versus the men who are alive and present and vital. And it's not just about age, because like I said, Ray is one of the good ones, I think, and he's old as shit.
Yeah.
It's also speaking of like
except in the right light, then except the right light, then he's 25 again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
So something like we talked about the, I think every piece of the puzzle coming at the dinner scene, except for the aunt and uncle come in and accuse her of robbing the store.
Right. And she just forgot.
And she's like, oh shit, I forgot the deposit. Like, I didn't even know that was a dilemma. And they come into the summer, like, it's like every, like, that's got to be part of the comedy, right? Like, there's like six different beats in 10 minutes where you're like, oh, the shoe's gonna drop, or like, what? Because, like, I thought for a split second, I'm like, oh my God, did she steal their money to give herself a makeover?
Exactly. That's what I assumed had happened when she
and
was
like,
doing
why?
This.
Is this happening? Like, oh, this is such a weird. And then it's like, oh no, it's I forgot. Mm-hmm. I just got so moonstruck. I forgot to make the deposit. Here it is. Oh, we never suspected a thing. Like,
right.
What
right.
the fuck? I don't know. That's the vitality that the movie has. And Frasier's dad is missing. So I didn't feel like it sucked the life out of me. I felt like it injected life into me.
Yeah. And that's why I say
through his life injector, you know.
I don't want to say that I don't like this movie. I think there are some odd choices. And I think Cher's dad, Cosmo, is maybe the... Him and Danny Aiello are both putting in very strange performances for me. Cosmo is trying to be Italian Rodney Dangerfield, and it's not fucking working for me at all. Like, just watch him. He's Rodney Dangerfield.
Then
Aiello,
a cup of pipe can't get any respect.
Right. Danny Aiello's choices in this movie
are so strange. What did you think? Because I thought that's Johnny,
when he's
right?
Like, yeah, and he's calling from Italy or Sicily or whatever. He's like, I'm calling from my mother's deathbed.
Wasn't that Cher? I thought that's a scene that I thought confused. I rewound it and watched it. Is that not a... I thought that was maybe a fantasy sequence. The Cher is imagining what is going on
it feels like fantasy because she's relating.
She's relating the phone call she had, and like she couldn't believe how like loud her mother was crying, and then it was like in her mind's eye she's picturing him standing at it and like, you know, seeing his angelic mother losing life and him just bursting out in the tears. And I thought that
I
was
know
like
what it was, but I hated like every second of that.
Like Raising Arizona scenes where like he's being stalked by this the biker dude. Like there's some like some enhanced reality shit going on.
Maybe I thought it was all real, and I thought it all sucked.
Was that the only one that? Because I thought he was like his whole proposal scene too.
His whole
role in this film was to be a plain corned beef sandwich. Like, no salad dressing, no cheese, no lettuce, tomato.
I just couldn't tell if any of his stuff was supposed to be comedy or serious, especially early on, because I'm like, I don't know what this movie is yet. And when he's talking about, like, I'll ruin my suit if I get down on the fucking stromboli-covered floor of this Italian restaurant or whatever the hell it is.
How filthy is this fucking...
Take a knee, man. You're not going to ruin a suit. I don't care how expensive that Italian suit is.
But like, right. It's also like, I guess what she was willing to settle for.
But then he fucking knee walks across the damn thing up and down the aisles, right? So yeah, I'm like, okay, well, maybe you will ruin a suit doing that, you idiot.
He puts on a show.
But I don't know. I hated his performance in this. I've seen him in things that I like him in, but not this.
I'm so curious to see what you would make of Joe versus the Volcano, because that's got a lot of like... I think it's hilarious, but it's also got a lot of those like in-betweener, questionable, like offbeat things that I might drive you crazy. I don't know. And it's the screenplay is the same guy. So I see a lot of like Joe versus the Volcano DNA in like trying to find the absurdity, like the absurdity of these weird situations. Like this guy who says, oh, I don't want to. But then you're right. Like a normal guy gets down on one knee and proposes. But a normal guy would have a ring and have thought about it for three seconds. But he's making up by like, you know, fucking goose stepping on his knees up and down the Stromboli alley.
Right.
Like, so yeah. But I think that's again, there's like some there's some deliberate like, you know, she's asking for something normal and she's not getting it.
No, she'll never get it with that guy. Are you kidding me?
But the form itself is more important than its function. Like, you know, I need a proper proposal, and a proper proposal has to have a ring. Oh, I got my pinky ring. Oh, it's got to be on one knees. Oh, I'm strutting on my knees. It's got to have a time and date, a month from now. And it's, you know, like it's like a speed running for settling, you know?
Sure. Yeah. No, it was that. I'm just glad that he disappears for most of this movie, because I think he was easily the weakest character.
Oh, yeah. He's
the least nuanced character. He's
a plot mechanic is what he is.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. So
he is Marcellus Wallace's briefcase.
Sure.
Except for when we see him, we're not happy.
No.
What else we got to say about Moonstruck?
The only other thing I want to know, the behind the scenes that I hope exists, is what did Nicolas Cage's hand look like after the bread slicer incident? Did it come out as slices? Like, a bread slicer is going to slice a whole bunch of times vertically, right? I imagine it just fell away like a cartoon in meat slices.
Like, I thought
thick
the prosthetic
slabs of sandwich meat.
I thought the prosthetic was really nice looking.
It wasn't bad, yeah.
I mean, usually those things that clearly fit over an actor's hand are like twice the size, but for whatever reason, this must have been like the thinnest veneer. But it looked like, it looked like he was missing his hand. He just had this thing strapped
to his. And then Cage just acts it, right? He never moves that hand.
I don't know. I was trying to think of like, do you think a bread slicer is like a whole loaf operation?
I assume.
Like a simultaneously, you just pull down and just like. Because I guess I was thinking it was like, I don't know, if you go to deli bread, do they slice it? Like, do you want a thick slice? Want a thin slice? I thought it'd be kind of like that. Like,
does the deli slice bread for you? I've never had.
Well, where the hell was he slicing bread? Is he like there's a bread factory?
In the shop, I assume, but.
Huh. Yeah, I've never seen like a deli bread that comes like pre-sliced. Usually it's like if you either get the shit that's in the, but so maybe he's working a bread factory. I don't know.
I was just assuming
he was like essentially like the deli, you know, like
right.
You don't have the bologna slicer that does them all at once. you kind of like rocket through the thing.
But, yeah, maybe. But then how did he lose his whole damn hand? Like, you cut once and you're done. You can lose a couple of fingertips.
True.
But like,
that's true.
You're not going to lose your whole hand
slicing
one slice.
He was really distracted.
No. It had to be all at once.
This thing that Johnny was doing was so distracting. Like, it kept him like busy for 30. It's like, oh my God, I sliced myself to the stump now, Johnny. Right. You cut your hand. Oh God. It's funny, like, because I, sometimes I see Nick Cage's earlier work, because, like, my going into Nick Cage, he erupted onto my radar in, what was it? It was, The Rock.
Yeah.
Was that the first one in the Con Air?
Face Off.
Yeah. There's this run in the late 90s and early aughts where he was, like, kind of like this action star. Unlikely action star, and I'd always thought, oh, he's got this like prestigious past and background that right. He's well regarded, but every time I see the foundational works, I'm like, he's never not been a crazy person. Yeah. How did anyone, if he didn't have Coppola blood running through his veins, would he be anywhere or anything?
He would,
because
not.
it's all insane shit.
It is, yeah. But I love that about his back catalog too. It gets to the heart of a just fucking crazy actor who has ideas. He has big fucking ideas when he comes into these roles. He's like, I'm gonna make this thing my own, and you are gonna remember this.
Yeah,
in a way that he can't do today, because now he is Nicolas Cage. And every time I go back to one of these old roles where he wasn't Nicolas Cage, I'm so happy to see a new Nicolas Cage performance that I haven't seen before. Because there's always something. He never comes into one of these movies and is just a dude, right?
That's the thing. He's not a character actor, but he's damn near close to not being a leading man. Because he does, like, you're right, he's got all these crazy, but it's not a character actor because he's not playing a character. Right. A stock character, do you know what I mean? Like, when I think of character actor, I'm like, oh, you need a guy who plays that salesman.
You need the schlubby brother. You need this guy.
You need that
whatever.
Guy. You need, yeah.
But he's never going to give you what you hired him for either, right? He's going to give you whatever he feels like giving you on the day. And
that's the thing. Yeah.
That's what makes his performances so fun to watch.
Because I always thought like his best stuff was like in the earlier, but like, you know, I guess he was making his best stuff like The Weatherman, stuff like Leaving Las Vegas. Like, this was all happening in that same era. So like his kind of like high water mark as far as critical acclaim came at the same time he was doing all this schlocky pop culture action film stuff.
The thing. He works a lot.
He does work a lot.
Especially now. He makes 7-8 movies a year.
You can't spend $50 million on dinosaur bones.
It's true.
If you don't want to work, Jim.
It's true.
Those bones and haunted mansions in Louisiana.
Those mausoleums ain't going to buy themselves.
Hell no. And then you got to pay taxes on top of that. That's another couple of years you got to work straight. Divorces. Oh, my God. The hits keep coming.
Yeah,
it's a Superman hairline restoration project. It's so much money he's got to spend.
I mean, he's got a whole set of new chompers now too, right? I mean, if you look at his teeth now, they're immaculate.
Oh,
they're perfectly
straight.
Yeah.
No baby teeth to be found.
No, he's got canines now.
All right, well, that'll do it for Moonstruck this week. Next week, we'll be back with the patron selected Risky Business as the prestige film of the week. And then the ones up for vote, if you're a patron, patron.com/baldmove, is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, 2011's Life of Pi, and the film Lincoln, about President Lincoln, the guy on the back of the penny, or in the front of the penny. Yeah, not the back. That's his memorial.
I keep mine eagles up.
Keep yours eagles up?
Yeah.
We got Lincoln's down, eagles up. We got that coming your way. If you're a patron, executive producer level patron, you can have a say in which prestige film we do. Those are the slate that you can vote on. We'll be back with one of those three the week after. Enjoy Tom Cruise and Risky Business. Until then, until the next time, until we come back, it's 2022. I'm a little rusty. I got the Christmas rust, the New Year's rust, the old year's rust. Shaking it off. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with Risky Business. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.